High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of August 24th, 2020. Coming up on today's show,
retro gaming comes to Netflix.
A new Neo Geo bar top.
Crash Magazine is back.
A new floppy drive emulator for your classic computer.
And the Dreamcast lives on 20 years later.
All this and more on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
Netflix saw the release of a retro gaming documentary series this week called High Score. And I know that you've seen the first episode, John, but I've only seen the trailer so far. So I'll give you my first impressions and you can tell me if it's anywhere close to the reality of the series. It's created by France Costrel. She also worked on a series called 8-Bit Legacy, The Curious History of Video Games, and Darknet. And High Score is spread over 6 episodes covering the period from the late 70s through to the transition into 3D graphics in gaming in the early 90s. Now, watching the trailer, my first impressions are that this thing does have a decent budget. I think that much is clear. It's shot really nicely. It's got the big names that we know and love appearing in it, such as Nolan Bushnell and Tomohiro Nishikado. We immediately see Nintendo and Sega consoles. We see Sonic. We see Mortal Kombat cut into a courtroom with commentary about video game nasties. And we see an Atari 2600 ED cartridge presented as the worst video game of all time. Nothing at all wrong with any of that. But as someone who eats, sleeps, and breathes retro, this trailer doesn't tell me that I'm going to learn anything new. It says it's for a mainstream audience. And I think a lot of people are going to enjoy it. Perhaps a new generation of people will be encouraged to dip a toe into some retro gaming and try them out, which is absolutely fantastic. I'm all for that. But for people like you and me, John, it doesn't look like it's going to teach us a whole lot of new stuff. Now, you've seen the first episode. That's my assessment purely based on the trailer. Am I anywhere close to the mark?
I can tell you everything that you need to know from one sentence. About 5 minutes in, the announcer says, or the narrator says, if you've never heard of Atari, then... And that just tells you all you need to know, because this is for people that have never studied the history of video games. It's for a generation of people that grew up well after the rise and fall of Atari. And you have to go into it with that in mind. The series starts in 1978 with Space Invaders. That's the very first touchstone. And it continues forward through the Atari VCS and all of that side of things. If you are from the UK and you go in thinking that the UK scene is going to get a fair shake, prepare to become disappointed and or angry and start posting tirades online. I've already read several of those. There is no mention of the ZX Spectrum. There's no mention of any of the UK scene. There's no real mention of classic computers in the role of video games. It's a mostly console and arcade focused affair. And it's told entirely from an American slash a little bit Japanese perspective, but mostly an American perspective. This is for people that want to watch something light on Netflix and are kind of interested in video game history. I would recommend that you watch it just because it's kind of neat to see our favorite subject get the slick production treatment that a lot of these Netflix original documentary series give. It's very well done, and they tell the story of these games through the eyes of personal stories, which is something that a lot of documentaries do these days. So, for example, they start the Space Invaders story with a person that competed in a Space Invaders competition in like some mall in the 80s in California. And it's a person that is a transgender person. And she says that this was the first time that she felt like she could compete as a female in the world of video games. And so they tie things in through personal stories. If you're looking to get a cut and dry history of video games, there's a million and one videos on YouTube, including some by you, Neil, that I think would give you a more full picture of the history of video games from a more cut and dry point of view. But if you're looking for something to introduce somebody who doesn't know anything about the history of video games and they have been raised on a diet of Netflix documentaries, so they are familiar with the production quality and things like that, you certainly won't get bored. There are tons of quick cuts. The editing is very clever, but it's not going to be for everybody. It's for the mainstream.
I'll certainly give it a go because it's those personal stories that you've just mentioned that appeal to me, because every now and then you just get a nugget of information in those personal stories that you haven't heard before, even though it's embedded in this story you've heard a million times before. So just for that fact alone, I will give it a try. It's 6 episodes. They've got over a decade of history to cover in just 6 episodes. So in their defense, they're trying to cram a lot in. You can find it on Netflix now. The first episode is called Boom and Bust. So do give it a try, and we'd love to hear what you think of it over on our This Week in Retro subreddit.
Neil, fans of SNK will surely be waiting with bated breath on the news of a new bar top unit from Unico called the MVSX Home Arcade. This machine will include 50 pre-installed Neo Geo games from the likes of classic brawlers like Fatal Fury. There's a bunch of one-on-one fighters like Samurai Showdown and some of the best arcade sports games ever released like Super Sidekicks and Baseball Stars. This thing is a real looker too. It gives you the classic red and white color scheme of Neo Geo cabinets, the red on the sides, the white and red striped control panels with the multicolored buttons. This thing looks gorgeous. And there's even mini marquees that you can put on the top of the unit just like its full-size arcade cousin. The MVSX can be purchased as a bar top, but they also give you the option to buy a stand that will elevate the machine to almost 5 feet, about a foot taller than Arcade 1-Up's cabinets. So Neil, for people with limited space, does having a bar top machine actually save that much room over a stand-up cabinet?
I don't think it really saves a great deal of room, does it? Because you're just losing the bottom half, which would be unusable space anyway, because you've got it on your bar top. I guess it's nice to be able to swing your legs underneath it on a bar stool, perhaps. But no, it doesn't save a huge amount of space.
I know that the Neo Geo was a huge success in the United States. You could find these arcade machines in places where normal arcade machines had gone by the wayside. For example, you can still find Neo Geo machines in places like laundromats today. I think one of the main advantages is the fact that you can swap out those cartridges so easily, and you can put multiple games inside one machine. But was the Neo Geo a big hit in the UK as well?
Yeah, UK arcades were full of them. You could always hear that distinctive Neo Geo attract sound. And also, if I ever went to sort of specialist gaming shops, I would always look out for the imported Neo Geo consoles. So we did get them over here, although they were very uncommon to have in the home. Looks-wise, I think they've nailed the colour scheme, as you mentioned. It's that classic red and black Neo Geo colour scheme. It's got the authentic-looking Neo Geo joysticks, and if that's got the same kind of throw and feel of the originals, then that's perfect. It looks like, from the picture that I've got here, it looks like there's T-moulding on it, but I can't be sure if that's just black-painted. The one thing that stands out, in last week's episode, I was talking about arcade machines and being a bit of an arcade snob in my past, although I've loosened up a bit now. But one of the things I mentioned was that you could buy replica arcade machines and they didn't even have the light-up marquee. And looking at the picture here, I can't see a light-up marquee in the mock-ups.
It is odd because a light-up marquee in this day and age of LEDs everywhere, making a plexiglass marquee with a LED backlight would be incredibly easy to do and also incredibly cheap. I don't know why they don't go this way if this is not a light-up marquee. So, Neil, if you're interested in this thing, you can go over to snkmvsx.com and put down your money. This thing costs, you can either buy it for $450 in the bar top alone version, or you can spend $500 and get the bar top plus the stand. And I will say the stand is not just a generic stand. It actually makes it look like a real Neo Geo MVS cabinet. It is a very sharp-looking piece of kit. I just hope that the controls hold up, the interface is good, and I'm sure these reviews will start rolling in. This is going to be released in November of this year. Thanks to Paul, aka Hermsky, for submitting this story on our subreddit.
Crash Magazine is back. It's a legendary magazine among ZX Spectrum owners of a certain vintage, famous for its eye-popping cover artwork by Oliver Frey, and an editorial style that spoke to young gamers in a way that arch-rival magazine Sinclair User was unable to. In recent years, the Crash name has been resurrected by Fusion Retro Books, and we saw a special edition of the magazine kickstarted in 2017 and subsequent Crash annuals, which have had input from the original editor Roger Keane and artist Ollie Frey, which of course make it feel extremely authentic. But now it's been announced that the magazine is making a return as a quarterly magazine. Now, off the back of this news, I gave Chris Wilkins a call this morning. He's at Fusion Retro Books. And I asked him all about it. And the first thing I noticed was that he was extremely excited because he needed 500 people to sign up to make this magazine possible, to make the costs feasible. And he's just gone to 504 backers. So he's crossed that line and the magazine is happening, which is great news. You can subscribe to the magazine at patreon.com/crashmagazine and you'll get yourself a PDF. It's less than £2 for the PDF. And then you can get a printed edition also for a little bit more, which will ship internationally. Chris has gone for an A5 format, and there's also a binder available for it, which is smaller than the original magazine. But Chris described it on our call as a mini mag to fit the current trend of mini retro machines. And I have to say, I quite like that idea. So John, Amstrad Action was the very first computer magazine that I used to go out and buy. How about you? What was your first?
Neil, I was always hopelessly behind the curve growing up. And when I would get a new system, the first thing that would happen is all of the magazines devoted to that system would go out of print because the new thing was right around the corner. So I grew up with the Atari 8-bit computer, the Atari 1200 XL. And I used to get copies of Antic magazine where my dad had a work friend that subscribed, and he would at work Xerox copies of Antic magazine. So not only did I pirate all of my software as a child, I also pirated the magazines. I will say that one of the things that I'm most envious about the UK computing scene of the 80s is the maturity of the magazine market. You guys had tons and tons and tons of magazines for all the different platforms, and these magazines were really well done. The review sections were fully fleshed out. Whenever we would do the Our Sinclair podcast and have to look up reviews for games, there were always, you know, six or seven different magazines oftentimes that would give you a score and a review. If you look at US-based computer games from the same time, it's hard to find anything. So you really grew up in the golden age of magazines.
Mm. And was it Antic magazine, did you say that you
That's had? Right. Antic magazine. There were two for the Atari 8-bit. There were Antic and Analog. I never saw Analog until I was an adult, but Antic magazine, it was pretty good. It was full color, and it covered the Atari 8-bits mostly. There was always a small section devoted to the ST machines, but as time went on, that section got bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually Antic was renamed Start with a capital ST to reflect its total moving over to the dark side.
And as you've read Crash magazine, going back to look over those old reviews, you'll have noticed that it is aimed well at its audience. You know, it really is down with the kids, if you like. Mm-hmm. were your magazines a bit more, you know, professional in its approach?
Yeah. The magazine was definitely written towards an older audience. If you look at the advertising, there were a lot of advertisements for business software. The games advertising and even the games coverage was pretty subdued. You can compare it to what you might find in a Macintosh magazine, like something like Macworld now, where there's a section for games, but the vast majority of the content is going to be towards productivity. Sure. Neil, how do you feel about this being an A5 format?
Well, I think you have to remember that the later editions of these magazines, when the platforms were starting to die, you remember just how skinny those magazines got, partly because of the lack of advertising. And partly because just the lack of new games and software coming out for these systems. It wasn't a good time for magazines. So let's be honest, in the modern day, there isn't a huge amount of Spectrum news. So you do risk creating, you know, those slim looking magazines again if you go full size. So I think the mini format works both for its presentation and for modern day convenience. A little A5 binder full of your Crash magazine sounds like a fun thing to have next to the system.
Move over, GoTech. There's a new USB floppy controller in town. OpenFlops is an open hardware floppy drive emulator that works with most classic computers, including the Acorn, Amstrad, Amiga, Apple, Atari, ZX Spectrum, and IBM PC. Neil, have you ever noticed how many computers start with A?
It's true, yeah.
Developed by SucoPera, this new board directly supports a wide range of image formats and contains an easily accessible pin header to attach an OLED display or one of those fancy rotary encoders. There's a built-in amplified speaker And get this, it has the ability to emulate two drives simultaneously. It comes delivered in the same form factor as a classic GoTek and can easily be installed in any shell or enclosure designed for it. Now, Neil, where do you stand on these floppy drive emulators? Do you have a GoTek or something similar?
Oh, yes, this story certainly has my interest. I have a GoTek. I have it with the flash floppy firmware on there. I love it. It just gets rid of all those problems with dying media. As lovely as it is to have the big boxes on your shelves, you can never guarantee that those games are actually going to work anymore. So it's convenient while giving you an authentic experience. I do like these things.
Yeah, the ability for this thing to emulate two drives simultaneously really puts it head and shoulders above the original GoTek. And I like the fact that they're keeping it in the same form factor. So all your 3D printed cases that you made or you might have purchased for the GoTek, you can take the old GoTek out and slot this thing right in with no trouble at all.
And the one thing you have to remember about these floppy emulators is that they do operate at the original floppy speed. So they're not going to give you a speed boost, but they do give you a massive convenience boost. So yeah, I'm a big fan of them.
Where do you stand on these things, these solutions for the Amiga? Are you more of an ADF guy loading up on your GoTek, or do you go to WHD load?
Oh, I've got both on different Amigas because I have the luxury of having multiple Amigas. But give me an A600 and I'll put in a bit of extra RAM and a compact flash card and WHD load all day long. But give me something like an A500, which doesn't have an IDE controller built in. What I've done with that is I've put a GoTek in an external floppy drive and I've put a floppy drive switcher inside the Amiga so that it treats the external drive as the internal drive, so there's no compatibility issues, without then having to cut up the case. Because I know some people choose to cut the case up to squeeze this thing inside the computer. I like to do it in a non-destructive way. So it sits really nicely in an external case. And then what I've done as well, because I have two GoTeks, I mounted a second one in another external floppy drive casing and daisy chained that into the first. But by the sounds of it, with this new one, I can do away with the second one altogether and have two floppy drives in one. So that does appeal to me.
Different solutions for different setups. We live in a golden age of retro computing as a hobby. All right, Neil, you can purchase the OpenFlops emulator at the link in the show notes, and 50p of every sale goes directly to support the Center for Computing History in Cambridge. Thanks to Soy de Madrid for submitting this story on our subreddit.
It's hard to believe that it's been more than 20 years since the launch of Sega's iconic Dreamcast, although it was collectively steamrolled by the launch of the PS2 a few years later. Sega's final console still has quite a devoted fanbase. Therefore, it should come as no surprise that the second volume of Dreamcast history has come to the press on Kickstarter. Dreamcast Year 2 is a hefty volume full of reviews, news stories, and insights from the biggest names and the biggest fans in the scene. And get this, John, one of the Kickstarter rewards is the Dreamcast Year's podcast pressed on a mini disc. The Kickstarter has surpassed its goal of $15,000, so if you want to get on board, now is the time, and there's less than 24 hours left at the time of this podcast's release. So, John, what are your Dreamcast memories?
The first time I ever saw the Dreamcast was my freshman year of college. I entered university in 1999, the year of the Dreamcast release. In fact, I believe that the Dreamcast was released in the United States on September the 9th, 1999, 9999. And I remember seeing Soul Calibur and being blown away. I had never seen anything that so closely looked like an arcade game in the home or in the dorm room, as it were. The Dreamcast has always had a special place in my heart because it was the first console that I could run an NES emulator on. I remember that the Dreamcast, of course, from the get-go, one of the things that doomed it was the ease at which you could pirate games, because I believe that you could just put a plain old CD-ROM in the Dreamcast and make it work somehow. I don't know how it worked. The Dreamcast was really special because, number one, it could run emulators. Number two, all of the big Sega titles looked fantastic on it. So anything from like Virtual Racing to Sega Bass Fishing, all of the games that I loved that were coming out in the arcades or had come out in the arcades from Sega, you got near perfect arcade ports onto the Dreamcast. It was a really special system, and I did mourn it when it died, especially the loss of the VMU, that little Tamagotchi-style memory card that you could actually play little games on. It had a little screen and everything. How about you, Neil?
Yeah, it was the heyday of the Naomi arcade board, wasn't it? And mm-hmm. This was a consoleized version of that board, effectively. And it did a great job. My first memories are when a friend of mine at college allowed me to borrow his new Dreamcast for a week. So I actually got to take it home and play with it. I had Power Stone, I had Sonic Adventure, I think it was, and Ready to Rumble Boxing. And the first thought I had when I saw it was just how sharp it looked. It was a definite next generation console, even though it kind of sat between generations. You know, it was 2 years before the PS2 came out. But that should have meant that it had the momentum to really gain traction and become a huge hit. But as you said, it was the piracy that was really its downfall, because the next time I got to use a Dreamcast was a friend called Jean-Pierre's. I went to his house to play on it, and he just pulled out a stack of copied games. I don't think he owned a single original game. And as soon as I saw that, I knew its cards were marked. But yeah, whenever I go back and look at the Dreamcast, look at its games library, I always enjoy it. It holds up well today. And I think I should probably devote a little bit more time into reading up on its history and some of the things that I missed out on, particularly in the Japanese market. So what can we expect to find in this second volume of the Dreamcast history?
This is really an almanac. There are all kinds of different articles in here. There are articles about the history of the hardware at the time, all of the games that were released during the second year, retrospectives on special genres. So like there's a whole article on the 2D fighting genre in the Dreamcast. There's really something for everybody in here. And I think that you'll get your money's worth. If you pledge £12 or $16, you can get a digital copy. And of course, the hardback copies are more expensive. But if you're a Dreamcast fan at all, I think that you will be pleased what's contained in this.
And don't forget, if you're a mini disc owner, then get on board for your special mini disc. I can't imagine there's many mini discs.
Did that ever cross your mind when you were releasing the Hoffman Sessions out of the cave to put it on mini disc?
Funnily enough, it was asked. It was asked, but I just thought it was being asked in jest. But maybe it was a serious question.
So this thing has raised $28,000 out of its $15,000 goal, 825 backers, and there are 29 hours to go. So if you want to back this project, just Google Dreamcast Year 2 Unofficial Book on Kickstarter.
Today's episode of This Week in Retro comes thanks to our partners at Anchor FM. Whether you're new to the game or you have an existing successful podcast, Anchor FM offer a home where you can extend your audience and find new sponsorship opportunities to make it the most successful podcast it can be.
That's right, Neil. We love Anchor, and that's why we use them to host This Week in Retro. You should check them out at anchor.fm for more info.
So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.